Good morning and welcome to our session on cloud computing, content in the cloud, opportunity or new risk for records management. My name is Mary Beth Herkert. I'm currently the state archivist for the state of Oregon. And we'll just start with a brief introduction and overview of what the session is and then introduce our speakers and then let them have at it. This should be a very interesting, exciting and informative session on yet one more technological advance for records management and records managers and archivists. And let me just say that every time a new technology or new advancement in technology occurs, I always make sure that my hairdresser has extra hair color in stock because I know I'm sure to sprout a few new gray hairs. And I think between social media and cloud computing, there aren't very many black ones left. So what is cloud computing, and what's all the fuss about? I'm not going to go into any elaborate discussion, as I'm sure our presenters will cover that very well and provide you with all the information you ever wanted to know about cloud computing and were afraid to ask. A very simplistic definition of cloud computing is basically the outsourcing of an entity's IT infrastructure to a third party virtual network, which is shared by other entities trying to do the same thing. The best illustration of cloud computing that I saw was on YouTube. It was a YouTube video, and unfortunately my link no longer works to that YouTube video, but it was very simplistic and informative. Information may go into one cloud or many clouds and may be stored domestically or internationally, and all these issues lead to real issues that we have within government and the private sector. The key is that you no longer own or control your information or where it resides unless you explicitly request that as part of your agreement with the cloud provider. And sometimes that might get a little dicey. Some of us may have dabbled in cloud computing already using software as a service. We're on the fringes of that. Or even outsourcing such things as email, which you may fully be in a cloud if you are outsourcing some of your email. The pros of cloud computing are obvious. It's easy and fast to implement. It's cost effective, and there's little need to build up your infrastructure. And with shrinking budgets, these are all very attractive reasons to go into the cloud. The cons are just as obvious. Privacy and security are big issues. Location of where the data resides, whether it is onshore or offshore, and where it physically resides within the network are concerns, and as well as how do we control the management, retention, and disposition of the information that we're storing on the cloud. And these are just a few of the issues that will be discussed by our presenters today. And our first presenter is Bob Ballard, and he's the Government IT Strategy Advisor for Microsoft. He's worked for Microsoft for 10 years, and currently he serves as the cloud expert and previously worked in communications and collaboration for Microsoft. Our second presenter is Mark Jaeger, and he's the lead information technology specialist for the Office of Records Services Modern Records Program of the National Archives in College Park. His primary responsibilities include advising in the formation of government electronic record-keeping regulatory policy and assisting federal agencies in the design of electronic record-keeping system. He was formerly the electronic records manager for the City of Philadelphia. He has served as an adjunct faculty member at a number of universities and taught courses. And he has a doctorate of information science from the State University of New York at Albany. And without further ado, we'll begin with Bob Ballard.
Hello, everyone. Had a little crazy ride on the way here this morning. I live about 50 miles away, and it took me 4 hours and 25 minutes to get here this morning. In the wonderful weather, some of you were probably stuck in it yourselves. I literally walked up 5 minutes ago, terrified that I was going to miss the beginning of the session. Of course, I was first, too, which made it great, right? So I've been with Microsoft 10 years. I was a communications collaboration subject matter expert prior to my life as the new cloud guy for state and local government. I did a number of talks on records management topics as a Microsoft collaboration technologies expert as well. So I kind of have a little bit of affinity for this group. Did a lot of conversations around, you know, e-government, digital records management stuff once upon a time in my life there. So when we start talking about the cloud, you know, I love some of these decks come from my boss who has a pretty keen sense of humor. But, you know, the reality is, the funny thing is, number one, I think most of us hate the term cloud computing because it's used to answer everything. It's one of those words that, you know, just kind of becomes so encompassing that you just have to work it into whatever you do somewhere so that you sound relevant today, right? Forget all I said about SOA, service-oriented architecture yesterday. It's the cloud thingy today, right? You know, there's a lot of hype, and the word itself doesn't help at all. So I actually spent some time talking to Florida State Legislature in sort of a lobbying event talking about cloud computing. They had a statewide email consolidation project going on, and we want to make sure, you know, we were talking about, you know, what Microsoft has to offer, et cetera. And I went in and out in those great 15-minute, you know, legislature meetings that you get there, and not a single one of 35 people had any idea what cloud computing was, right? So that's sort of what you're up against. I think there are CIOs today that don't actually totally understand what cloud computing is when they say the word. They just know it's important, right? And the big key about this is, you know, when we think about the cloud, right, it's just the tool in the toolbox, right? A lot of times, especially in tough economic times, I only work with state and local government customers, there's a lot of value. I'm so busy, my team went from 2 people to 8 people in months, right? So there's certainly a lot of interest in it. But it's just one option that there is. And I think we all have to remember that it doesn't solve. If you have a whole batch of problems, unless you sort of, you know, use it as part of a step to eliminate those problems still exist, right? You just inherit them someplace else in many cases, right? Some people say, what's the best kind of analogy you can use to do cloud computing concept for dummies, right? And so the best thing I could say is, you know what? Sometimes I don't want to own a TV station. I just want to watch TV, right? And at its core, that concept is really what the core of cloud is and why it's different than sort of traditional outsourcing models that have been out there before. Because a lot of times in outsourcing models, what you're doing is they're very structured and arranged agreement between two parties where lots of the details are hammered out. Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad, right? One of the jokes around outsourcing is your mess for less, right? So that whole thing about all the problems you have, you just give them to someone else, and yeah, they're their problem, but ultimately some of those problems still exist, right? And the cloud computing model is, I have some things that are sort of commodity driven, right? You know what? I need a mailbox. I need email. I need a collaboration portal, right? I need a way to collaborate around documents, which would be pretty relevant to all the folks in this room. I need something. Give it to me, and I want to order it a la carte per user per month, right? Sometimes they require commitments, sometimes they don't, but that's the idea, just like your utility bill, just like your cable TV, et cetera, right? So one of the other things that we talk about are, you know, there's sort of 3 or 4 different models here, and I think some of this will be relevant. You know, I'm the guy that gets to explain what cloud computing is. I think Mark's going to get in a lot more specifically, you know, how it relates to you and your world, but I think some of this stuff is relevant to know what you're dealing with, right? Is it infrastructure as a service where we just sort of give you a new place to hold your infrastructure? Well, that has maybe not as much effect on this crowd, right, potentially. It's just whatever policies and procedures and methodologies and technologies that are there, maybe they're just going somewhere else, right? And then a platform as a service, depending on what we do with that, right, that may or may not have some impact. If there are records generated out on this application, you think about platform as a service. Microsoft has an offering here where we just say we have an environment out there on the internet ready to go to just accept your applications and run them very efficiently and scale tremendously. You know, the example we see in government of these things all the time, any citizen service-facing application that has deadlines involved with it, right? You need a tax application, right? So you sit around and you run at this level 360 days a year, and you run at this level, as I knock the mic, you run at this level 5 days a year, right, as everyone's filing their taxes, right? So those kinds of things. And then software as a service, which is primarily the truest of the cloud plays, which is this whole commodity idea of I want to consume a unit of collaboration. I want to consume a unit of an email mailbox kind of thing. The other part is, you know, there's sort of four major ways we look at the cloud, right? You know, the private cloud, we see that in government, right? So every government now, because again, we love this word cloud, every central IT organization, I shouldn't say every, 75% are looking to put out the insert state here cloud powered by central IT, right? You know, and that's, they use, you know, this is my private cloud, right? And then sometimes that private cloud could be housed by a third-party organization, but it's just you, right? And then we kind of have this public cloud, right? And that's the traditional speak when we were talking about internet-facing cloud organizations, right? Multiple tenants. It could be the state of Nebraska, the state of California, or it could be Joe's garage in the corner, and they're all mixed together in an environment, right? And there's some economies as to why that's attractive from a vendor perspective, and as a result, as consumer of that because it makes it very inexpensive, right? I don't have a lot of rules around that stuff. And then the community cloud, which is a new popular thing. You see some talk about government clouds, et cetera. You know, there's a lot of debate on whether that's really relevant at all from a security perspective, but it certainly makes people feel better, right? That my I know who my neighbors are going to be, and those neighbors will be other government entities. But I'm not certainly certain that, you know, the fact that you know where all your neighbors work means that you're not going to get robbed, right? You know, that I don't know that that makes a big difference, but there's certainly a lot of push around that, right? And it's an interesting dynamic. And, you know, we see them in government in particular now, but you see that also growing in other communities, right? And then the last one, which I think is where the government world will be for any time in the foreseeable future, it's unlike government IT is complicated. Right, as you guys try to sort and store all the artifacts of that, right, you know as well as anybody else, right? So government IT is very, very complicated. And so it's unlikely that you're just going to say, I'm going to push the magic button and everything goes out into the cloud and we won't have any sort of intertwined interconnectivity required, right? And so the hybrid cloud is really where I see the majority of my customers in some way, whether it's within the same application or within kind of collaborative environments, right? So why do we look at this, right? So when you guys are tasked with how do I unravel this thing that I've gotten, you know, my organizations have gotten into, it might be useful for you guys to say, why do we care? The big one across the front, particularly in today's era, right, is for cost efficiency. I always joke when I do my cloud presentations to customers that if the cloud cost more, we wouldn't have gotten past the first slide, right? So it's about saving money at the top. However, there's a lot of other very intriguing aspects to this. Agility, flexibility, efficiency, transparency, I kind of bundle those all together. Government IT can be slow to adopt. Certainly it can be resource challenged versus financially, the human capital of what it takes to get on the newest and the latest and the greatest, et cetera. And what we find, by the way, in both the commercial world and in the government world, this huge drive towards compliance and improved features around those kinds of things, which help this room, right? The problem is that I can't be on a technology that was 7 years old to get those features, right? I need to be on the newest one. So, you know, the desire to get there. Another big one, one of the major issues that we see, across my customer base, right, is that, major statewide or top 10 metropolitan cities that have no real disaster recovery plan for an email system, for instance, right? You know, and no budget to ask for doubling the budget to do that because it costs twice as much as one copy, right? Pretty much. And sometimes more than that. Sometimes it's 3 and 4 times as much because now we got to find another data center. We got to share time with it. We got to get space in it. We got to do all those things. So those are huge ones. Some other ones are just allowing better and greater access to it for remote usage. There's a lot of work from home initiatives to help save money besides the fact that the thing saves money in the first place. And one of the last ones we see that's really intriguing around states that have pushed agendas around carbon footprints. I'll just use our data center because I know the facts and figures on this. But this is true of almost all, cloud-based data centers. They're some of the most efficient data centers in the world from a power consumption place. And the reason why is because the number one cost in running any data center is the power, right? So if I can drive my cost down through, you know, power efficiency, through hardware, through whatever we need to do to manage that, there's some great innovation being done there by Microsoft and all the other major cloud vendors there. We use the typical data center that's a cloud-based data center uses about 75 to 80% less power than the average everyday singular data center does to do when you talk about what when you scale it up to the numbers. So another thing that I think is really important, and I cut this down from a much larger presentation that I do that typically takes an hour and a half all by myself, and I think Mark probably appreciates that I didn't take up the entire hour and a half, but I left this slide in because I think this is something that's critical to kind of the overall evaluation and perspective on this. And that is, so just because it's cloud and just because it's an application that looks like it might have the things that you want in it, it's absolutely critical to kind of look back and make sure that the, you know, when we're talking about preservation of records, right, that the security model from both the data center stuff, which is great, right, because data centers all list their certifications and they're wonderful and great, right? But also look at the applications themselves, right? Because all code not created equal. I'll use again, speak from my own experience on this, you know, the Microsoft Exchange code is vetted by the Defense Department, right? So they actually leverage it. So, when we're looking at kind of the security principles that are behind the code, it's great that I have all these layers of security and I can talk about the certifications my data centers have. But if I don't validate for blank passwords, then my data integrity is violated and then the actual records themselves are potentially, you know, not accurate any longer, right? And, you know, that can be a real problem. And then this is pretty much the last slide and kind of my intro, because I think this is really relevant. The method in which I do the document collaboration and storage, et cetera, is really important, right? So, a lot of vendors do it a lot of different ways, but you need to have discussions with your organizations that are evaluating these cloud-based solutions that they don't, in fact, alter the record upon importing them into their solutions, right? So this can raise serious compliance concerns both in the now and then just from a document fidelity perspective, which truly alters the record on some level, right, can have huge impacts, right? If I am converting documents to pliable and flexible formats like HTML, right, just make sure that you fully understand what's happening with these records in these storage formats so that you're okay with it and that they meet the standards that you're setting forth. And that's a conversation you need to have across the board, right? I don't think a lot of people, you know, they kind of have a notion that it's going to work the way that I do things now, just a little different and more flexible and on the web. And that's not always the case. And so I think you really need to sort of take a look at that. When you keep things in their native format, that's always the preferred standard, you know, in my conversations anyway, with archivists is, you know, I'd like to keep it the way it was originally created as best as I can. And as soon as you start going away from that, then you have to wonder, you know, what's the standard there and how far does it deviate? And if it does it deviate so far that I can no longer consider this a record, right? And that's a potential issue, right? So with that, I actually didn't mean to have that slide in there, so I'll just skip over that one. That was an extra one at the end. So with that, from my side, that's my kind of cloud 101 and consideration things. I'm going to turn it over to Mark at this point to go over his.
Good morning. So who else has horror stories of getting here this morning? Anyone experience the tornado, the hail, elevator outages, trains breaking down? Welcome to D.C. in the summertime. Here we go. Thank you. So I'd like to pick up where Bob left off and spend a little bit of time trying to put this in some sort of archival records management context for you. I don't want to overpromise. I'm not going to have solutions for you for the nebulous and all-encompassing cloud. I'm going to more or less, I would hope, I'll tell you first of all some of the things that NARA is doing, and let you pull from that portions of the discussion which may or may not be applicable in your particular environment, and hopefully spend a good amount of time at the end of the session just talking about some of my personal conjectures that sort of speak to the elasticity of the profession or not, and see if you how you react to some of the concerns I might express, my own personal opinions. So here's a little background. This is what the thoughts, how the presentation is going to progress. You may or may not be aware that the National Archives put out an FAQ back in January about cloud computing, which was, in NARA speak, an FAQ is little g guidance, as opposed to big G guidance, which means it has to go through a lot more external vetting, it has to be cleared through OMB. Big G guidance is generally promulgated as a bulletin, which is advice directly from the archivist to the heads of federal agencies. The bulletin, and basically what I've done, the bulletin is not released yet. It's undergoing the final round of review. Final. We hope to have it out by September 30th. And it builds on the information that was in the FAQ. There was a feeling inside the modern records programs and on the part of the archivists that we needed, because this was such a hot topic, we needed to get something out fast and quick. We usually don't do an FAQ and then follow up with a bulletin on the exact same points. Well, there's a little bit more replete information. I also want to make sure you understand that this is a collaborative development effort, so there are actually many people in the audience here who were involved in one way or another in either contributing to the content inside NARA or federal agency assistance from federal agency partners that have more experience operating in the cloud than NARA does at the present time, that all came together to produce the bulletin, which I'm basically going to be briefing you, even though it has not yet been promulgated. Some of this, you know, you hear it three times, maybe you'll remember it. So here you go. Everything that we're doing is based off of the NIST definition. The National Institute of Standards and Technology out of the Department of Commerce is the interpretive authority for the federal government specific to technology matters. The Information Technology Lab at NIST has promulgated this definition. You'll see we're up to version 15. It's continually changing. If you actually go there and look at it, you'll see that they're a little sly. Sometimes the words change and the number doesn't. So it's actually probably more than 15 times, version 15 that we're on. But this more or less syncs with what Mary Beth described and what Bob described, just more governmentese, if you will. This presentation, by the way, will be on the SAI website, and all of these hyperlinks take you to the places where these things reside. I want to apologize. I realize these slides are busy. Part of the reason they're busy is not being able, the timeliness with which the bulletin will be promulgated by the federal government is now out of our control. So I wanted to push out all the information that is in that bulletin to you via these slides. So I understand slide etiquette and how many words you're supposed to have on them and how small the font is supposed to be, and how many sub-nested levels of detail you're supposed to have, but this is to get all the information in the bulletin out to you. So here is points that were spoken to by Bob about some essential characteristic of cloud computing, and this is a major IT initiative for the administration. So we're talking about the ability to on-demand provision computer services. We're talking about the ability to access these services from anywhere on any multiple different type of platform, BlackBerries, mobile phones, you name it. So there's a platform independence to the access method. There's a broad geographic independence to how you can access these services. And there's the ability to pool these resources so that you can get a better deal on the bottom line. Rapidly ramp up is, in Bob's example, for tax services, you know, that time when everyone has to file, all of a sudden you need a much bigger infrastructure, you can provision those services quickly. And there's an essential characteristic of measurement. So not only might you, as a cloud procurer, be able to measure, but the vendor will also measure for you so as to optimize the resources that you're using in the cloud. So there's always this continuous measurement, depending on how you've specified the agreement, going on in the background about you need more, you need less, how can we work this out? And as Bob alluded to, there are sort of two overlying matrices here, which gives you, there are three aspects, there are three what they call service models in NISSpeak that Bob described. So you can basically buy your infrastructure in the cloud, the whole bang, the whole shebang, the whole kit and caboodle. You can buy a platform in the cloud, or you can buy particular applications in the cloud. So that's sort of like your matrix of three going this way. And in NISSpeak, if you overlay on top of that the deployment models, which are, you know, this is my cloud, nobody else can play in it but me. This is a shared cloud, which we came together and pooled our resources to obtain. This is a free-for-all cloud open to the world, anybody who has an internet connection, or some sort of hybrid of those two. You've got 3x4, so you're basically ending up with a matrix of potentially 12 different types of, oh, I have no more NISSpeak to offer to you. I'll have to make up a word. I'll give you MarkSpeak. I don't know. Deployment scenarios. And when you're trying to consider the archival and records management implications of these, I don't think they're all going to be equal across the 12 aspects of those matrix. Some of them are going to be very, very problematic, potentially, and some of them are going to be probably very, very trivial. So out of this, this is from the administration. This is the big omnibus catalog that makes the case for cloud. And there's hundreds of links there if you go there. Examples I've just shown you. I've shown you a federal, a state, and a local example. The federal example, infrastructure as a service, you can't get there because it's private. That's where, you know, things happen that we're not supposed to have access to. The state example I provide you is an example of software as a service, where New Jersey Transit is doing CRM in the cloud. And a local example of platform as a service, the city of Miami. Anyone from the city of Miami here that can attest to the 311 service? So these are just examples for you to go to and get an example. But if you go to this report, you can see a huge catalog of various types of deployments in each of those particular service models. So now let's start getting to what you care about. Is there a problem? I mean, is this just people getting overreactive or hyperreactive, saying, oh my God, it's the cloud, we're all going to die, we're not going to be able to manage records? Maybe, maybe not. This is a matter of personal opinion, and I'd like to have some discussion about that afterwards. Let's put on the dour hat for a second and try to think of what the problems could be. I know it's much easier to put on the dour hat than to put on the happy face, so let's do this one first. If, you know, this is a train, this is a freight train that's moving through the station at like 75 miles an hour, and it's not stopping for you to get on. At least at the federal level, that's what's happening. Because in Bob's third to last slide, you know, these are the perceptions of the benefits, and the benefits are real. So when those outweigh the things that you're responsible for, implementing specific archives and records management statutes, policies, procedures, and regulations, that could cause you a problem. Because you're just going to have sort of like have to put your hand out, grab onto this thing, and go from 0 to 100 in like 3 seconds and get your arm ripped off. Besides, I mean, you're not going to be able to stand there in front of the train saying, oh, slow down, let's talk about records management and archives. That's probably not going to happen. Because there are such perceived benefits, these services are being procured, you know, probably without your assistance, your consideration, your discussion. I guess this second bullet is a slightly different flavor of the first bullet. It is unclear yet, depending on, you know, which of those 12 little matrices that you're sitting in, there may be problems inside the particular cell that you're living in that may be insurmountable from a records management perspective. And this will get to my last philosophical slide. And then, you know, there's this last one is sort of just thrown in. You know, we encounter this all the time whenever there's a new technology that hits. You know, there's this perception in amongst the unwashed that, we manage the cloud. Go and records manage the cloud. And all of the, you know, 100 years of history here that you've built your profession on, you know, where you manage records based on form and function that they document. You don't records manage a technology. You know, it's just like, well, it just happened. You know, think back, you know, records manage the web. Or now it's records manage the web 2.0. Well, that's not the way you're the washed. I don't have to explain it to you. But that's just another communication issue problem that you have interacting with the people that are on the freight train that's going 100 miles an hour through the station. So let's get to let's take the dour hat and pull it down a little further on our heads and start talking about what are some a little bit more specific problems that we can have. Well, at the highest level, you know, it's what we do. It's inherent in what we do. Records get scheduled. They're kept for a particular amount of time. Based on how they're appraised, something has to happen to them at the end of their useful life. Well, that whole notion may be difficult to implement depending on which of the 12 cells in the 3x4 matrix that you live in or your whichever particular train. Actually, so there are 12 different trains, so whichever train your institution has decided to get on, or maybe it's taking multiple trains, you're going to have to figure out how to introduce this notion. One of the more complicated aspects, depending on which cell you're living in that matrix, is the notion of binding the metadata, which you all know about, to the particular records that are floating in some nebulous ether out there somewhere in some data storage place that you don't know where it is, and it's getting intermingled with a whole bunch of other stuff from a whole bunch of other people. And depending on which deployment model you're in, you know, people may or may not, you know, if it's not private, if it's not just your cloud, there may be, how should I say, some metadata incongruencies that may develop. You're all familiar with the notion of destruction. Well, what does destruction mean in a cloud environment? We're all familiar with the long and impressive series of lawsuits, some at the federal level, about what incomplete destruction means. I'm sure all of you that have been to the Cohasset Conference have heard horror stories about the practice of arbitrary and capricious record keeping because you didn't throw away the stuff that you were supposed to throw away. Well, what does throwing away mean when you're in a cloud, and how are you sure that it's just not sitting there? I mean, as you all know, delete doesn't mean delete. It just means remove the pointer to the file. So you're just sort of making yourself three more times removed if you're saying, oh, I want to delete that, and when what's actually going to happen is in some nebulous data center sitting somewhere on the planet that you're accessing, are they removing the pointer? Are they actually getting rid of the copy? I mean, once ahead, we're ahead of the law here. I mean, there is no jurisprudence. There is no body of case law. There's jurisprudence, but no body of case law yet about, you know, someone being called on the carpet for inappropriate or incomplete deletion of things that were supposed to be deleted according to a particular record schedule so that someone can be accused of arbitrary and capricious record-keeping practices. But I'm sure that's coming down the pike. And because this is such a new technology, and as Bob alluded to, not all these things are equal, other than the marketing, potentially, is that standards are still being developed, and those standards could affect how the data is stored, and potentially introduce trustworthiness and accuracy concerns, authenticity concerns. I mean, are the formats unilaterally being changed without your knowledge into a mode that enables, you know, who's on the ACL about who can go and change things once they put it in some format, which wasn't the format that you created the record in, or whomever created the record in the cloud. I mean, has it been unilaterally changed? Has it been changed into a format that's more universally accessible to other people? These are significant concerns for archives and records managers. You also have to be, I mean, one of the hallmarks of what we do is we set aside a record keeping or an archival copy. Well, what does that mean? How do you do that? What does it mean? Can you get it out of the cloud in the format that it was put in the cloud, move it to another place, like your record keeping system? Is that a possibility? Or is the particulars of a cloud deployment so proprietary that you're going to have a hard time getting this stuff out so that you can records management potentially somewhere else? That's a concern. Okay, let's start taking the hat off now. We can crawl out of the hole. And, I mean, there is some means for hope. As I said, particular when you do your own analysis of the matrix of the deployment models and the service models, and you see where you live, which you're all going to have to do for yourselves in your own particular juridical environment, you know, some of those cells might be less problematic than others. You know, they're not going to cause you too many problems. So that's a plus. And there are standards that are being developed. But, of course, the standards are dealing with issues at an aggregative philosophical level above the nitty-gritty that you're going to need to do when it comes time to, you know, implement disposition or associate metadata with a particular record in the cloud or move it out of the cloud and put it someplace else. So these interoperability standards are going to help you, but they're not going to solve your problems in total. So if you're in an organization that's embarking on the train or one of many trains, you're going to have to develop particular tactics to try to, after your analysis of problems, to try to figure out how to make things better. So some of this is stuff that I'm sure you're always familiar with, and we hear it every time we deal with a new technology. Get involved in the planning. Get involved in the procurement. Some of this is records management 101. You know, get policies out there that specifically address which are record copies, how recordness is determined in a particular cloud environment. Now, I don't mean to imply that just because you're in the cloud, it's like, oh, none of these concepts that we've already dealt with apply. I mean, any good records management program is based on, you know, making sure that the people that create the records have an understanding of what records they're creating and when they're creating it and what the threshold for recordness is. So that's still the same, but it may or may not be any different in a cloud environment. You also have to look for whether or not existing record schedules are applicable to the material that's in the cloud. I mean, don't fall into the cloud mindset, the trap. It's like, oh, it's in the cloud, it's something different. It's the form and function of the material that's being created in the cloud. You probably have existing disposition authorities that already apply to much of that material. Of course, built into that, giving ourselves a little bit of wiggle room, and speaking to my last notional slide, which we're almost at, is the notion that you're going to need to think, the archivist, whether or not this cloud deployment affects the valuation judgment that you make during appraisal. Does the cloudness change the value, even if you had a previously existing disposition authority that may apply to the material that's being created in the cloud? I'm not saying yes, I'm not saying no, I'm not an archivist, I just pretend to be one on TV sometimes. But you may, I mean, the archives is doing studies now, I don't want to conflate two terms, we're doing studies in the Web 2.0 arena, which is, you know, can be overlaid to some extent with the cloud environment, and there are cases, there seems to be some data that the inherent nature of activities in the cloud may warrant different appraisal decisions, even if you're talking about stuff that, you know, looks like a series that you've already scheduled and you already have determined a valuation of it. Okay, where are we? So part of what you have to do is you have to educate your users. I mean, first you have to do an analysis, then you have to figure out if there are deltas, and where there are deltas, you're going to have to, just as in any other records management scenario, provide information to your end users that are using this technology, that are procuring this technology, that are creating records in this technology. There may be new records that are created that you haven't scheduled before. So, of course, you have to develop retention schedules for that sort of information. And it would probably behoove you, in all of these scenarios, to try to get record-keeping copies out. Don't wait till the end and then discover, oh my God, we can't get it out, or oh my God, it's all proprietary, or oh my God, a river washed away the data center and their coop plan wasn't what they said it was, and it's all gone. Figure out what's involved in getting things out of the cloud and putting them into your record keeping or a record keeping system. Which is not to say that maybe someone will come up with a deployment where there's going to be, you could deploy records management applications in the cloud potentially as part of a software as a service. Not to mix apples and oranges. Instructions on how to migrate data, which is a different flavor on how to get it out of the cloud. Once it's in the cloud, I mean, if it's going to stay there for some long period of time, what formats are you going to migrate it to, depending on how long it's going to be there before you yank out the record-keeping copy? Data governance issues that will gain you some traction in your conversation with the early cloud adopters in your organization. You say data governance, and their ears will perk up and say, yeah. Well, that's a double-edged sword. Data governance is something you can use to gain traction with them and make entree to start talking about records management stuff, but don't be led down the garden path that data governance equals records management equals everything's wonderful and we don't have anything to worry about. You're going to be the skeptic on this vote, unfortunately. How you spin that politically is going to be a testament to your adaptability. One thing that's in the bulletin is actually a clause that we suggest. It's a minimal clause. This is not to say that this is the legalese end all and be all and solves all your problems, but for the federal government at GSA, you can go to the apps.gov, which is the big cloud vending platform, and as part of that, there are a whole series of terms of service clauses that can be appended to the contractual language in the federal acquisition rules to procure cloud services. So we ginned up a generic, multi-purpose, minimal, let me say again, minimal, one more time, minimal clause that could be used or is of the ilk to convey that you need to build some boilerplate in that deals with your concerns, if at all possible, at the time of procurement. You probably need to get a lot more specific than what's provided here. But the notion is get yourself a placeholder if you're able to intervene. And, you know, the train is like, this is applicable when, you know, you're getting on board the train before the train hits a cell of speed. If the train's already moving, you're probably not going to have the ability to go modify the agreement until the agreement's recompeted or the contract lapses or they go with some other cloud vendor solution. So let's get to the last slide that I hope will engender some discussion. These are just my thoughts, not the thoughts of the National Archives. So for all of you National Archives people out there, I said it. Technologies come and go. I mean, you can think back as to how many technological paradigms we've moved through in our professional careers. Yes, there are some very good business drivers, very appealing business drivers for the cloud. There are certainly, you know, economies of scale that are going to be very attractive to many different types of organizations, both large and small. It's not clear But I mean, just play it back in your mind and think back to your particular favorite technological change of the past 5 to 10 years. And just play it back in your mind and just evaluate, well, is it as prevalent as it was then, as it is now? Did everything they say about it then, did that all come to fruition or not? I mean, I'm not going to play Karnak here and say, oh, yes, 2015 cloud is taking over the world. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but at this stage, take for me personally, I take the marketing I take the marketing with a grain of salt. Unfortunately, I think, as I have alluded to in the train analogy, the train's left the station, or left the 12 stations. They're all at various, depending on where you are in your organization and which trains they've launched, you know, you're either trying to get on it at the beginning if you're lucky, you're trying to, don't stand in its way if you haven't and it's already left the station. You got to figure out a way to get on the train. I'm not necessarily sanguine in the belief that the conductor of the train is going to be willingly letting you on. It is unclear to me personally, but there may be some insurmountable problems for certain particular deployment models and service models. So there, what does that mean? And in the reality, what does that mean when you match that up against the first bullet? When you say, how do you have a conversation with your big IT, you know, your state CIO, your city CIO, the federal CIO, your agency's CIO, or the CIO of some other, you know, agency that you're interacting with, and broach the conversation saying, oh, I just saw the RFP for, you know, something in the cloud, and there's a big problem here because of X. That's going to be a difficult conversation to have because, you know, records management, as you all know, is frequently the bastardized stepchild of, you know, regulatory and statutory doings in organizational situations. And finally, the one that I think you should spend some time thinking about, it would be nice if we could have thought about this, you know, if we had prescience and we could have known that this was coming down the pike, because this is the one, the last one's the one we should have, it would have been nice to have had time to do first. Because, you know, right now you're in a reactive mode, you're sort of trying to gauge, you're not unclear. You may not be clear with the technology. You may not know where it's deployed. You're probably still doing analysis to figure out whether or not it does really cause you problems. And then there's this lingering thought at the bottom, the profession thought about, you know, as a profession, we need to start thinking every time we go through one of these technological boundaries, you know, there's this professional reexamination about concepts that may or may not apply. You know, does series still apply? What does series mean when you're living in the realm that, you know, you're doing Google Mail, and the answer from Google is, not to pick on Google, you're doing Google. You're using Google Mail, and, you know, not to pick on Google, but you can, the answer you get when you say, well, I've got to do this thing called a series, and then look at you go, what? What the hell is a series? Oh, it's like, oh, it's this group of body of related records that are based on form and function, and they're looking at you like you're coming from another planet, and they say, don't worry about it. You can just use search technology and artificially recreate your series afterwards. Okay. I'm just suggesting things you might want to think about. I'm not saying that the discipline is out of step. I mean, we do have concepts that may be applicable. You know, affiliated archives comes to mind. This is just me talking off the top of my head. I really want to get back to the three slides ago, though, and talk about, you know, the valuation determination, which is the value that archivists add, the determination of permanency or temporariness. Is that extensible, and does that change or not in a cloud environment? I'm not necessarily suggesting it does. I'm just saying institutionally and professionally, perhaps that's something that might warrant an examination or perhaps a discussion in the American Archivist by some wise sage among you, brighter than myself. So, is that it? I had another slide. Oh, I hit the wrong, I think. So, please look at our blog so that you will see the bulletin as soon as it comes out. That's the first place it will be posted. Or go to the SAA COSA archive. What is this conference called? Archives? The Archive Star Records. Go to the Archive Star Records website and download the slides, and you'll basically have the bulletin. And if you have any questions, feel free to send me an email, providing you get through the spam filter, and I'll be glad to entertain any questions you might have. So at this point, I'll turn it over to questions from the audience, and very good.
Okay, questions from the audience, right here.
So I'm going to repeat the question so that everyone can hear them. So essentially, the gist of the question, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that that cost savings could be short-sighted based on the fact that at some point when the project comes out of the cloud, then we have to deliver it back to somewhere to store records for 10, 20, 30 years, and has everyone thought through those notions and ideas, right? Is that the gist of the question? And are we really saving money at that point, right? I can start. I don't know if you want to. I think that's a great question. What we're running into, the problem, and I see this even from Microsoft's perspective, but also across the industry, it's difficult for an IT vendor, for instance, to look much further than 10 years out. Right. So when we do records, when we have our sort of records management archiving options for our products, they end at 10 years. And the question comes up. So having some of the background that I had, right, which was I used to work with some of these, state archivists, et cetera, when I used to talk about that stuff, the first question they come back to me is, OK, so what happens in 10 years? That's an unknown question. I think it's vendor by vendor. So we have a policy, right, that says at a minimum, right, we'll give it all back to you, right? Now, whether that still continues to save you money when you have to figure out what to do and ingest this data and store it somewhere else for X period of time, et cetera, I'm with you. What I think is going to happen what I found is interesting is the government space is actually the ripest for this cloud movement, right? Because of a lot of the things that mapped to that first slide that I did that they're struggling with. So if you look at a lot of the vendors, right, they're attacking that space aggressively because they're in the most desperate circumstance for disaster recovery, better flexibility, cost savings, and all those things. So, the struggle that I think we'll have is, as we look forward, is, there's going to have to be some fate that the vendors are going to figure out what to do with this, right? And the reality is, so here's the truth. These cloud vendors can store this exponentially more inexpensively than you can. If you take the three biggest cloud vendors in the world today, they buy 1/3 of all the available storage produced in the world on a monthly basis, right? So every other entity known to man buys the other 2/3, and three buy 1/3, right? So at the cost savings, I think that things are lined up for that relationship to continue past year 10. The issue becomes contractually them being willing to commit to that past year 10. So I think that's a great question that's unanswered. I wish I had this magic answer for you. The idea behind it, of course, being 10 years of cost savings to then be moved to more expensive storage still saves money as opposed to 30 total years of expensive storage, right? So there is some level of that, but I agree that there certainly needs to be that product. That's something that I raise within my own product teams regularly. Commercial folks don't care about that stuff, right? Just governments, really, right? So that's an issue. That's a fight that I have to have internally all the time, actually.
Well, I mean, this gets, is this one on? Is it on? No. Yes. Okay. I mean, this gets to where, I mean, I think that, I agree, this is a very interesting question, because here's a way in which you can articulate a notion that may get you a ticket on the train. You know what I'm saying? I mean, the big post, whatever, hoo-ha, I mean, there's many ways in which you can sell the benefit that you bring to the program that will pay for the expense for your ticket to get on board the train. Perhaps, you know, you make the continuity of operations argument that records management can support. I mean, vital records perspective. I mean, I think you could somehow potentially, in some sort of business case development, either before the fact or after the fact, angle in on the end of this engagement aspect and potentially bring some value to the table there that may buy you a ticket on the train.
I'm not certain this is inherently a net new problem, however, when it comes to project-based data anyway, right? So you needed to get on that train for those conversations, whether they were stored in, you know, so how much does a project cost? Well, we've got to keep the records for 30 years. I don't know that it's any different than it is today. Now you just have maybe a two-stage process you'll have to deal with, right?
This gentleman right here.
So I can start with that, and you might have your own thoughts on that. I don't know that it – so there's a couple of things that you have to consider. Number one, I don't know that it changes things that much in that even on-premise storage requires continuous maintenance and revenue, et cetera, to keep operating, right? Because at a certain point, every piece of hardware dies off and you have to replace it. And so once you move things digitally – you know, there's always a maintenance and upkeep of that. So I don't know that part of it is any different. What I think is different is, you know, the decision to make a bet on the particular way you implement the storage is more important, right? So if I'm a scientist and I'm storing data, I just hand it off to IT at some point and assume they're doing mostly the right things, right? And hopefully that they, you know, their history of doing the right things allows that to happen, right? If I bet on a cloud vendor, you'd want to, in consideration of this kind of historically significant data, you'd want to make sure that that vendor seems to be a viable one, both past and future, and that the likelihood of them suddenly evaporating is low. Right, because they're, you know, in any, you know, cloud is one of those cliche words, and there are a lot of people on the cloud bandwagon that don't have much of a history at all, right? And some of them, may be around for the next 50 years, but some of them may not, right? I mean, IT is littered with those stories, right, of the next great thing that was dead 8 years later, right? And so. So that kind of consideration when you're looking at this type of data, it's not so much that they'll need to be in the business forever or that you have to bet the cloud's going to exist forever. You just need to bet that they're going to handle your data in a responsible way were things ever to change, right? And I think that's a consideration that's different than maybe the past. But the other stuff is the same, right? I got to maintain the fidelity of this data forever and pay for it forever or however long my records are required to be kept. I don't know if you have any other comments on that.
No.
It can get dicey, and it's how you enter into your agreement with or what you're doing, and it's the whole idea of managing your information, because you're entrusting your information to a third party. It's outside of your entity now to manage it, so you need to understand what their rules and regulations are as far as managing. For example, With the state of Oregon is in the process of doing an email software as a service agreement with Outlook in an Outlook environment, and one of the things is if you want to use that as your storage system, which is not encouraged by any means, then you have to enter into a separate agreement with the vendor on your own. So the state is saying this is just the avenue to provide the service with. You're still responsible for the ownership and the management of your information in some other form. So that's where the ownership that I was talking about can get cloudy.
Yeah, I just like to add that it's very vendor specific,
right? And so that's a buyer beware scenario that varies radically from vendor to vendor to vendor. And that to make sure, you know, as one of those vendors, I don't want to be in a situation where I'm not providing what the expectations are. So I challenge anyone who is in this circumstance to say, get very clearly, you know, in writing, what is your data stewardship policy, right? How, you know, who owns the data technically, right? And there's also who owns it sort of operationally, which is what I thought a little bit what she was alluding to as well is, yes, you know, theoretically speaking, I have a contract that says you own the data. However, if, you know, my data center imploded tomorrow, who owns your data, right? You know, really, right? So just how is all of that stuff delivered in writing and challenge those vendors to those? Because I think that's a critical piece, especially from this perspective, right? No, actually, that was when Mark was talking, the thought that ran through my mind is, and you know, we're talking about, you know, does this change how we look at the records and all, you know, all the kind of questions that were presented. I think when new kinds of content are a part of the solution, in other words, something that didn't exist before is now existing as far as how we're, you know, the types of records we're creating, et cetera, like Web 2.0 and things like that, I think those things are radically different and you have to reevaluate. But for the most part, what we're looking at is just a new delivery vehicle for the same content. Right, and you know, so we were talking, just whispering during Mark talking. Sorry, that you know, there's a you know a records management in the cloud RFP out, right? So you know, just because the word cloud is associated with it, doesn't automatically kind of degrade what you're going to be able to get out of it. I think what you're the same sort of products and work product and records that are delivered as sort of you know the process that you're doing. If those things stay the same, then I think you should have the same expectations and demands from those things, right? It's when those things change or when they're, you know, when there's lots of restrictions placed around them that's when you should challenge. But at the end of the day, you know, I'll take the Microsoft perspective. A Word doc is a Word doc, whether it was created here or there or stored there or here. And if it's somehow labeled a record, it needs to have a retention schedule and everything else. And our products that are living both on-premise and the cloud have to respect those things. I mean, that's our take on it.
Yes.
So how it could be a vital interest. Well, one of the effort behind that is, so we talked about, you know, when we talk about the infrastructure as a service and software as a service, et cetera, you know, the cloud data, the management infrastructure interface, rather, is really about making the process to leverage cloud storage repeatable regardless of the vendors involved, right? So the idea behind that is now if I make it behave much like on-premise storage and it's just this consumable commodity like we talked about the cable TV thing, so yeah, maybe it's not email boxes and maybe it's not, you know, units of collaboration, but it's units of storage, for instance, and there are a lot of vendors that's a major part of their entire play. I don't know how it radically changes things other than the SLA behind that at the vendor level, right? So, again, it's just a place I'm putting those things, and our applications are going to interact with them much in the same way they did before. So the question then just becomes, you know, do I have a great way to get the data out if I need to end my relationship with you? Do I have, you know, am I assured that data is backed up or replicated to multiple locations so that I can meet sort of my own governance requirements, et cetera? Beyond that, and, you know, maybe you have an idea that I'm not thinking of, I don't really know where that would impact things beyond those types of things. Just make sure what the underlying sort of SLA and contract looks like. From your guys' perspective. Right. That's a great point. That the idea behind it is that, you know, it behaves much like raw storage would anywhere, right? So it doesn't actually strip things out or make modifications. They're having a party.
Are we supposed to do a song and dance now or something?
having a party next door.
Other questions? Yes.
Well, I guess I sort of, this is Mark, okay? I mean, I'd sort of reiterate two components of Bob's two last responses. I mean, I don't necessarily think that that there's anything inherent in having records reside in the cloud that is going to cause you to revamp the whole notion of how legal holds are implemented, other than having contractual language or service level agreement language that says, you know, this may be something that we have to do. Now, that's as far as just preserving your ability when you interact with a cloud provider to be able to implement holds. What that technically means behind the scenes, depending on which of the 12 cells you dwell in, may become a little bit more complicated because, you know, holds are very touchy subjects, and when you tend to get rid of things or not sure how many copies of things you have when holds are put on them, you know, judges interpreting holds can get quite prickly. So I don't think that there's anything inherently difficult about doing it. I think it'll be a function of how that gets implemented that may be a little bit more sticky.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I mean, primarily the function of legal hold, et cetera, are done at the application level, right? Whatever application you're participating in, whether that be email or in records management systems, et cetera. And, you know, so as long as the vendor that you're participating with from a cloud perspective, you know, honors those as either part of their own application or as the storage mechanism for some other application, you know, you should be safe there. I know when I mentioned earlier, by the way, that, you know, Microsoft really doesn't look beyond 10 years in our, you know, promised storage. That actually goes, that it does not apply, though, to objects placed on legal hold. And we actually sign in our contract language that says if something's placed on legal hold, we will hold it forever. And I can tell you we're pretty risk averse from a legal standpoint. I am stunned that they would put that in writing, but they did, right? So forever is a long time. And especially in IT, and we actually stepped up and agreed to that. I think many vendors do, right? It's not unique to us.
Other questions?
Now, I think it's a great question. Essentially, I'm going to repeat the question, make sure that I'm accurate on this, and that is, you know, the relationship between central IT and state organization and the archivist is generally pretty good, or in your case is good, where you struggle is, you know, and by the way, as a vendor, we struggle with this notion too, right? There's a central IT that either is or isn't of authority in a state, and it varies greatly from state to state. And then there's a whole series of agencies that either sometimes listen and sometimes don't to those, that central IT. And where the problem comes in is that individual agencies making choices and what that impact would be on your records management system. Is that pretty much the question? Yep. No, I think that's a great question, and I think that that's a problem that's not unique to cloud, right? I think it's a problem that's in state government is a huge problem across the board, right? You know, especially in a situation where the vendor doesn't have a relationship with central IT to begin with, right? So, you know, fortunately in our case, most of the times we have to tread delicately in those conversations because at Microsoft we always do have some sort of relationship with central IT as well as the individual agencies, right? But if I'm new to the ball game and I'm walking into a state as a, you know, an enterprise vendor for the first time and with this great story around cloud and saving money, et cetera, I'm going to look for the lowest hanging fruit and where I can make my strike first. I think probably, you know, the only way that I could see mitigating that is going proactive with, you know, hey, look, I just got back from a conference and this topic came up and I know that this isn't something that's being investigated, whether it's via email or a note or something. Now, whether they pay attention to it or not is a whole nother story. But at least there's some sort of record of the fact that, you know, you tried to steer them into not which choice to make, but just to consider these things when making a choice, right? And then the only other play from your guys' position to sit is to try to leverage whatever authority central IT has. And in some states, it can be almost none. In some states, it can be great amounts of authority, right? If the purchasing runs through there, then that usually wields more authority, right? Boom, I can stop.
More trouble. Yeah, right here. One of the things we've done in our state is gone directly to risk management and asked them what are the dollars that the state is spending on dealing with information management or non-management issues, and then the number is mind-boggling, and so therefore your insurance goes up, and the amount of money that they're paying out before even getting to court is amazing. So it's kind of like finding out, going looking at the other players, not necessarily your traditional players. You know, the CIO, I have a great relationship with the CIO, but there's only so much that he's going to do for me. There's only so much the Attorney General is going to do for me. But if I can show real dollars, and that's one of the ways that you can do it, is look at risk management and look at how much money the state is spending on managing, mitigating risk, or settling out of court.
Actually, there's a government-wide Google email pilot that NARA is involved with. It is what it is there's two aspects to the project. One is the development of a government-wide RFI to procure a government-wide acquisition contract to procure cloud services generally, and there is also an IT aspect of this, of deploying it to a limited number of users within NARA. And they're sort of, they're parallel activities, but they're eventually going to merge again, so that the lessons learned from NARA, from both an IT perspective, a business case perspective, and a records management case perspective, can eventually be folded into the results from this RFI, so that when they actually move to a government-wide procurement, these two sets of activities can be integrated. It's a very small, as far as the actual IT aspect of it, the working group just kicked off. It's a very short time frame, and the number of people, users of NARA, that is being deployed to, I think, is nominal. It's like 50 or less. So, yes, we are.
Oh, yeah. So, well, what we got to be careful about is exactly how we define subscription basis. So, in general, at Microsoft, yes, we do. So, in just the month of June alone, the Microsoft US on the commercial side added 4.5 million seats of customers that from the commercial sector into, and primarily focused on email and our SharePoint offering, which is, you know, content repository, right? That's the bulk of those seats. And that was just in June alone. And those customers included J.P. Morgan Chase, American Express, major Fortune 100 companies. Now, on the government side, we have customers, as large as major top 5-6 states that are participating with us today. We added 61 new customers in state and local government alone in the month of June. That's the end of our fiscal year, so I have some data from that, right? So, because we just got done doing all of our number crunching from the end of the year. So 61 new customers. Of those, 28 are over 1,000 seats in nature, right? So that's substantial new business just in the last 60 days even that are moving on to, and again, the focus there, email, collaboration technologies, et cetera, is where the focus is. So that's, you know, the bulk of the content, right, usually lives in those two systems from a end user perspective, right, not necessarily records perspective, from an end user perspective. That answer your question?
Yes. Yeah.
Some of it we can, some of it we can't. So we were actually very respectful at Microsoft to, you know, different states and municipalities, et cetera, have varying degrees of policies around being a reference. Some of them are, there's no policy whatsoever. Some of them are very ardent about that, right? You know, they're just trying to, you know, absolutely, we cannot, we love you guys, but we're forbidden by statute, whatever. My email address, I might regret doing this, but my email address is rballard, R-B-A-L-L-A-R-D, at Microsoft.com. If I get inundated with them, it might take me a couple of days to get back to you. But I can give you a list of some of the ones that I know for a fact are publicly available.
and share those with you. Yeah, I think they're all great points. And I think one of the things that makes this sort of wave of things just slightly more interesting is sort of this, this aggregation of two trends. One, the cloud trend of hey, let's give it back to someone again, let's go back that direction, and the consumerization of IT at the same time. And why I bring that up is because half the cloud vendors kind of come from the consumer side of things, right? And so, so we have to be really careful when we're having these conversations, because you know what? If I come from the consumer world, I haven't the faintest idea about what you just talked about, right? On some level, there are some folks that do, right? But, that's not, and I've even watched it within my own company. Believe me, I've had these arguments, the evolution of SharePoint as a product and what it thought was a record and what it really became and all those things as that product's matured and developed over, and I said, XYZ company might consider that to be accurate from a records management and I've been 6 years in government now and on this stint and prior as well, those things are different. Right, what you think is right and what I'm hearing from those experts in the field are different. And so we've sort of been through that evolution ourselves. And many of the vendors in this space, they've got to go through that same evolution, right? What are real enterprise class features, et cetera, that are required in these systems? Your history and legacy is going to determine how quickly you embrace and understand those. Doesn't mean that because you came from the consumer side, you're not capable of doing it. It just means you have to be much more clear in defining those definitions with those vendors and making sure that what they're doing is, in fact, exactly what you're asking, because it could easily be different, right? And so I think those are valid points, and I think that kind of meeting of those two worlds is what makes this a challenge more than anything, right? Hey, let's just do it fast, quick, cheap, and simple. That's not government, though. Right, as much as we'd love it to be, there's not a history of it. They have too many rules to be fast, quick, cheap, and simple, right? And so that's a problem. And so we have to, we have to try to map back to that.
Okay. Well, thank you for your attention, and enjoy the rest of your conference.
It's a pleasure. Absolutely.